Hi guys, welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall, and it's just me today introducing this episode, as both John and Joe are busy this week. This is one that Joe and I recorded at the University of Bristol a couple of months ago, at the same time we recorded episode 12 on Paleozoic Problematica with Dr. Jakob Winter. This isn't a particularly long episode, but I hope you all agree that the subject is of fundamental importance for our understanding of the world around us. We do cover quite a bit of theoretical paleontology, so I'd recommend looking at our website, where you can examine the cladograms, evolutionary trees and timescales from the research paper, to which there's also a link in the text, which is free to download, so I hope you enjoy it. Cyanobacteria, formerly known as blue-green algae, are one of the most successful and diverse groups of bacteria, one of the three major branches of life on Earth. They have a fossil record stretching deep into the Precambrian, yet despite this, little is known about their origin, evolutionary diversity, or importance in the development of Earth's biosphere. Joining us today to explore the evolution of cyanobacteria is Bettina Schirmeister, an evolutionary biologist and research fellow at the University of Bristol. Hi Betty, thanks for joining us today. Could you give us an introduction about yourself and your research history, please?
Yes, of course. So I'm an evolutionary biologist. I did study at the University of Munich and did my PhD finally at the University of Zurich. So I just moved to Bristol recently. During my PhD, I worked a lot on cyanobacteria, actually on their phylogeny and their evolution. And now that I'm here in Bristol, I hope to explore a bit more cyanobacterial fossils, their fossil record, by using 3D imaging techniques and also do more genome sequencing to get a better understanding of their evolution.
So what are cyanobacteria?
Cyanobacteria are commonly known as blue-green algae. They are prokaryotes that do oxygenic photosynthesis. They are the only prokaryotes that do that. They are one of the oldest organisms on our planet, and they are one of the most diverse prokaryotic forms we have on this planet.
So what does a typical cyanobacteria look like?
So because cyanobacteria do oxygenic photosynthesis, they get a sort of greenish-bluish colour. So if you see lakes, for example, that where the water turns green, it's due to cyanobacterial blooms. That means cyanobacteria are growing really fast and you have loads of them in this lake. If you look at cyanobacteria in more detail, maybe under a microscope, you will see that we have different forms of cyanobacteria. We have single cells that are rod-shaped or multicellular forms, chains of different of round cells or filaments of disc-shaped cells. And if you even magnify higher, you could see that within each cyanobacterial cell, we have layers of membranes. These are so-called tulacoid membranes. Cyanobacteria, on these tulacoid membranes, you will have the light harvesting machinery, the photosystems, where the photosynthesis will take place.
Do we just find cyanobacteria in lakes or are there other places where we can get them?
Cyanobacteria are widely distributed on Earth. They only require sunlight, basically, or that's the major source they need. So that you can find them anywhere where there's sunlight. So in lakes, in marine environments, in soil, and you can find them in deserts, Arctic regions, temperate zones, everywhere almost.
With cyanobacteria in so many different environments and all over the world, are there quite a lot of different kinds of cyanobacteria?
Yes, indeed, there are a lot of different cyanobacteria. They are one of the most diverse prokaryotes we have on our planet. So we have unicellular forms, we have multicellular forms. We even have some multicellular cyanobacteria with cell differentiation. That means where different cells do different tasks. So we have several different cell types. And then we even have cyanobacteria where we have a sort of branching pattern. They grow a bit like algae. So yes, we have quite a variety of different morphotypes.
So you mentioned with the multicellular forms, how are these cells bound together?
In cyanobacteria, it's basically cell-to-cell adhesion. We have sort of filaments. They always grow in one direction. It's a unidirectional growth. And sometimes these filaments will also be surrounded by a sheath, which enables them to communicate over longer distances. So cells that are not really adjacent, but further away from each other.
Is it kind of like a packet of mints, in a way?
A bit, like, yes. Very good, yeah.
So each mint is a cell, and then it's got a sheath around it.
Exactly.
That's the wrapper.
Exactly.
So do we have any idea how all of these different forms of cyanobacteria are related to each other?
So in the 70s, people tried to group them according to their morphology. So we have different groups where multicellular cyanobacteria would group together and unicellular forms. But actually now that we have genome data and sequence data, we know that this is not the case, that often multicellular and unicellular cyanobacteria of a certain type might be more related to each other than to other multicellular or unicellular cyanobacteria. So actually, now that we have sequence data, we are able to look in more detail at the relationship of cyanobacteria, and we find that indeed multicellularity is not a criterion to say that they are all more related to each other.
So some multicellular forms are actually more closely related to some unicellular forms.
Exactly.
Than they are to each other.
Exactly, yes.
And how do you work this out? Is it just the comparison of the DNA strands? Do you say that this strand of DNA is closer to this one, therefore?
It's basically, so you look at sequence data of living organisms and you compare, so you get a set of sequence data, you look at differences in these sequence data, and from the differences you can estimate, for example, certain regions will be more likely to accumulate differences than other regions. So you take these data and you add an evolutionary model to predict how these differences might have occurred. And so you can reconstruct relationships of these living organisms and display them in a sort of tree diagram.
So in your evolutionary tree, you used DNA from ribosomes. Why did you use ribosomal DNA over any other genetic information?
So in my case, it was... First of all, I used ribosomal RNA because back when I did this study, there was not enough genomic data available. So genomes that had been sequenced of cyanobacteria would often be from unicellular forms. So we had an overrepresentation of unicellular marine cyanobacteria, but we knew that the actual diversity is much wider and much bigger. So I was sampling from a set of 1,220 taxa to get a nice small sample of cyanobacteria where I can do my analysis on. So that's why I picked rRNA, because this is a gene which is commonly sequenced to identify certain species. So we have a lot of ribosomal RNA available to use for study. The second thing was that ribosomal RNA is very conserved, so we can take it to actually compare species relationships on a genus level. It's a good tool to use for phylogenetics. Of course, it would be nice in the future to get more genome data and to use more genes and more sequences.
So ribosomal DNA accumulates changes more slowly. Why is that preferable to DNA, which accumulates changes faster?
Because if you compare species, it might be in genes, you might have certain forces that have driven the evolution of these genes. So they might be very different from each other. So you can't really compare them anymore. Whereas in 16S or in ribosomal sequences, you have certain parts that are highly conserved, which enables you to always align the different sequences. But then you have parts which mutate faster, so you accumulate also some changes. So it's a good tool to use if you compare species that are not, or organisms that are not really, really very close related, but already diverged some time ago.
So in this analysis that you did, it wasn't just the ribosomal DNA in cyanobacteria that you used. You also included information from chloroplasts, which are organelles within plants. Why did you do this, and what's the relationship between chloroplasts and cyanobacteria?
So, yes, you're right. Chloroplasts are organelles in plants where the light harvesting takes place. So basically, it's their light harvesting machinery. And so these chloroplasts are actually descendants from ancient cyanobacterial organisms. So at a certain point back in time, around 1.6 billion years ago, we had... a cyanobacterial cell that was indulged by a so-called proto-eukaryote, so a proto-plant cell, so to speak. And they lived together in an endosymbiotic relationship. So, but at a certain point, the cyanobacterial cell within the other cell would give up certain genes which it didn't need anymore and then lose its ability to live alone. So this is considered the endosymbiosis event back in time. And that's how chloroplasts are assumed to have originated. So in my analysis, I included chloroplasts only out of interest, out of curiosity, to see where in my tree they basically would pop out.
So chloroplasts are like the last vestige of an ancient symbiotic relationship between organisms, a lot like cyanobacteria and early plant cells.
Yeah, chloroplasts are the remains of an ancient cyanobacterial cell that now live within plants. So basically, if you take it, we have oxygenic photosynthesis evolving only in cyanobacteria and then been taken over by plants. So if cyanobacteria wouldn't have evolved oxygenic photosynthesis, we all might maybe not exist because there would not be any oxygen in the atmosphere.
As part of your work in the University of Bristol, you've begun to look at the fossil record of cyanobacteria. So your recent work has focused on the cyanobacterial fossils from the Gunflint Chert. What's the significance of these?
So the Gunflint Chert is highly condensed, fine-grained silica. It's around 2.0 billion years old, up to 1.8 billion years. It also contains a lot of iron, so part of it is abandoned iron formation. And we have in there, we have a set of different morphotypes of prokaryotic fossils. A lot of them are probably cyanobacteria. It's one of the earliest findings of cyanobacterial fossils, and we have quite a variety already back then. So we have unicellular fossils and some multicellular forms. So they are basically part of so-called stromatolites. So stromatolites, basically, they are calcareous columns that are normally usually formed by bacterial mats. So we have bacterial communities that are growing. Often they contain on top, the top layer will be a photobiont, so a cyanobacteria, for example. So they grow upwards towards the sunlight and supply, take sunlight energy, supply the rest of the community with nutrients. And so these calcareous columns, so these bacterial mats, they grow towards the sunlight. In the layers below, bacteria will die, trap sediment, and therefore you get these calcareous columns.
Are there earlier body fossils of cyanobacteria than the Gunflint Chert?
So there are earlier body fossils of prokaryotes, but we don't know for certain to which modern living groups they would belong to. So we're not sure that these are cyanobacteria. And indeed, we have stromatolites. The oldest stromatolites we know are around 3.5 billion years old from Australia. But we don't know whether they have been formed by cyanobacteria or whether cyanobacteria were involved in forming the stromatolites. Also, you have to be careful because there might be other processes that actually form structures that look very similar to stromatolites. So indeed, you can only be sure to really have a stromatolite being formed by prokaryotes if you find body fossils actually in these stromatolites. And so we have already a lot of multicellular fossils in the Archean Aeon, but we couldn't find modern counterparts to clearly say what sort of what type of bacteria those were. So the earliest cyanobacterial fossils we know of are, which are undoubtedly accepted, are the Gunflint cyanobacteria from around 2 billion years ago.
So can we use fossil data to inform the timing and extent of the evolutionary diversification of cyanobacteria?
Yes, exactly. We could do that. So if we have a tree diagram or an evolutionary tree of cyanobacteria of any organism and you have a good fossil record, you could try to take the fossils to date your trees. If I take a simple example, we have a species A and a species B, and you have a fossil from species A that has a certain age. You can say, okay, species, so this fossil, when this fossil lived, we already had species A. So species A and species B must have separated before that. So if you use this information of the fossil, you can already set an age, a minimum age, to this divergence event of species A and species B. And you could basically, the more fossils you have, the more age estimates you could calibrate on your tree, and the better you could infer when certain species did evolve.
So you can use fossil data to calibrate evolutionary trees, but that's not the only way that we can get age estimates. There's also molecular clocks. Can you explain what they are, and do they often fall in line with what the fossil data tells us, or do they sometimes conflict?
So basically, if you try to estimate ages on an evolutionary tree taking fossils, you kind of use molecular clocks. So basically, what molecular clocks say is Zuckerkandl and Pauling found out that basically sequences seem to accumulate mutations at a certain rate and that this rate seems to be constant. So that's this model. And if you take this, if you have a constant rate, you could infer on a phylogenetic tree when certain species evolved. So, but this is not, it's not that simple, because later on people found that species have different rates of evolution. So sequences do not always accumulate mutations at the same rate indeed, but can be very different. Even within a sequence, the accumulation of mutations might differ. So that's why you have loads of evolutionary models to help you infer ages. And but at a certain point, you need to start with an age. So that's where you need the calibrations, which you get from fossil data or biogeographic data, which you might incorporate in your tree to get a starting point from which on your molecular clock or your evolutionary model will then estimate when other species did evolve or diverge.
So you recently attempted to calibrate the evolutionary tree of cyanobacteria. What did your results suggest about their evolution?
So by taking these data from the fossils of the Gunflinchard and information we have of geochemical processes in the past, we were able to calibrate the tree of cyanobacteria, and we find that multicellularity originates very, very early. It seems like that it originated before the Great Oxidation Event. And that it also seems that after the Great Oxidation Event, the rate of evolution seems to increase in cyanobacteria. So it seems that we have a higher diversification rate, so more speciation events after the Great Oxidation Event. Basically, what this means is that apparently the evolution of multicellularity in cyanobacteria could have been a very important event leading to a higher abundance and a wider distribution of cyanobacteria in this ancient on this ancient Earth, therefore increasing the accumulation of oxygen, which subsequently will lead to the establishment of new habitat niches where bacteria can live in. And apparently cyanobacteria might have used these niches. So we have an increased speciation after the Great Oxidation Event.
So not only did the Great Oxygenation Event create new species of cyanobacteria, new niches for bacteria in general, they also created, well, it also changed the entire world, didn't it?
Yeah, so basically at the Great Oxidation Event, we have an accumulation of oxygen in the atmosphere and in oceans, establishing new habitats where bacteria can live. This might have caused some problems, because bacteria living before the Great Oxidation Event were not used to oxygen being in the atmosphere. So this might have been actually quite toxic to them. It might have killed a lot of bacteria, and so leaving a lot of new established niches empty, ready for colonization. It could be that cyanobacteria actually colonized these niches, because we see this diversification increases from our molecular data.
Is it kind of like a parallel to humans pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere now? It's actually a waste product and it's changing the atmosphere. Is it kind of like a reverse global warming in a sort of way?
So basically, oxygen was a waste product of cyanobacteria, and it indeed had quite a strong effect on the climate. So the climate would change drastically afterwards. And for the organisms living at that time, it could have been a catastrophe, so to speak, because it might have been quite toxic for most of the anoxygenic living organisms on the planet back then. Yeah, so it's kind of a big climate change.
When did the Great Oxygenation Event take place?
So people suggested that it was around 2.4 to 2.2 billion years ago, but there's always debate about when exactly, and so there have been some suggestions that oxygen might have already been produced 200 million years earlier. So it's still not 100% certain, but around that time. We also see it in the banded iron formation. So at that point, we suddenly have rocks where there's a lot of iron oxide. So beforehand, iron would be just massively around in oceans. And then when oxygen was produced at first, it would bind with iron, form iron oxide, and you get this like rust, this red color, which we find in some rocks. So this is sort of an evidence that we have oxygen is produced, and before it could reach the atmosphere, first it was bound with iron until all the iron was taken up.
What do you think is the future of cyanobacteria research? Do you think that through study of their fossil record and their evolution, we'll be able to say something about the co-evolution of life on Earth?
Yes. So I've already shown that the evolution of multicellularity in cyanobacteria might have been very, very important for the evolution of life on our planet. It could be that the evolution of multicellularity indeed made it possible to have such a strong effect in oxygen production, to make cyanobacteria so successful that they basically could spread to all these different environments on our planet and finally accumulate the oxygen in the atmosphere and finally, by endosymbiosis, lead to plants which supply our atmosphere with oxygen today. So definitely, looking at genome data and fossil data of cyanobacteria, I hope to get a better picture of how multicellularity evolved, at what time point exactly it evolved, and what kind of consequences it might have had, not only 2.3 billion years ago, but maybe also later on in the Precambrian.
So I hope you all enjoyed this episode. It goes to show what a neat and tidy piece of research Betty and her team had conducted. So they did a phylogenetic analysis. The results show that the evolution of multicellularity occurred just before the Great Oxidation event, and that the implications of that are world-changing. In reality, we could have discussed for hours the long-reaching geological and biological implications of an oxygen-rich atmosphere. But I think that understanding the revolution in form in cyanobacteria was a major factor in the production of this atmosphere is a fantastic starting point. If you've got any further questions about this episode, please feel free to put them in the comments section on the website. Or if you want a more structured discussion, then head over to the forum where you can discuss this episode directly with us and any other researchers. Also, I want to remind you all to look out for us at the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival. I know that the majority of you guys live outside of the UK, but I still think that this festival will be interesting for you, especially if you're into the Jurassic. The whole coast around Lyme Regis is a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and we'll hopefully be talking about its geology and paleontology. And also, there's going to be some really big names in paleontology going to be there, from the Natural History Museum, the British Geological Survey, British Antarctic Survey, and the Paleontological Association, to name but a few. So I know that there's going to be something in there for everyone, no matter where you're from. So I hope to see you all soon.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.